Hello, I'm Georgina Godwin and this is Monocle Reads. My guests today are Jonathan Calvert and George Arbuthnot. Both are journalists at Insight, the Sunday Times award-winning investigative platform, with careers that consist of some of the biggest scoops of recent years, including the FIFA files, cash for questions and doping in athletics. Their latest book is Failures of State, the inside story of Britain's battle with coronavirus, a damning expose of the ineptitudes of Boris Johnson and his government's handling of the coronavirus pandemic. George and Jonathan, many thanks for coming on to the show. This book came out of an article that you wrote. When did you first realise that actually this was being horrifically mishandled from the top?
Well, we were asked in a roundabout, it was the end of March, actually, last year, to have a look at why things seem to be going so badly in the UK compared to other places and why we seem to be kind of, the infections were rising so quick, had risen so quickly, we seem to be having so many deaths. And if you remember at that time, you know, kind of everyone kind of looked across at Italy, which had been the first to be hit by the pandemic, and they all sort of said, well, we're never going to be as bad as Italy. And it's quite clear we were. And we started off with a kind of question, which was, what was the Prime Minister doing? And what was his government doing to tackle the pandemic in those early days? And so we worked on this, our initial article, like, for a few weeks. And at the end of April, we wrote a story which was about the government's 38 lost days in tackling the virus. And I think as we were going through the research, it became clearer and clearer and clearer that the threat had not been taken seriously, even though the warnings were there, and that we were in a very, very poor state of preparedness anyway, rather than people who claimed that we were one of the best countries equipped to tackle a virus in the world. And we were far from it, because all the years of austerity and the kind of concentration on emergency planning for a no Brexit deal had meant that we were actually probably in our weakest state when it came. So what was vital was when you know, the news came out of China that there was this awful virus which was spreading quickly and it was jamming up hospitals in China already, that we needed to hit the ground running. And I think what we found in our initial research was that the government just didn't do that.
Mm. How much of that do you think was Brexit related? Because you make the point in the book that one of your sources said that following the referendum and the fact that multiple experts had argued in favour of the UK remaining within the EU, the government just stopped listening to experts.
Yes, I think certainly we spoke to emergency planners in charge of preparing our pandemic plans through to 2017, 2018 and 2019. And they just described how all the kind of normal meetings that they would have were just being bumped for the no-deal Brexit preparations. And one of our sources described talking to doctors who said that their kind of sweatiest nightmare was a pandemic emerging, because we'd become so unprepared over those years.
Mm. Now, the blame is really squarely placed at the door of three people, perhaps. You have the Health Minister, Matt Hancock. You have Dominic Cummings, the previous advisor to the Prime Minister, and of course, the Prime Minister himself. Now, one of the big issues during this time, and the fact that Boris Johnson missed so many of those vital early COBRA meetings, was the complete mess of his private life. Tell us more about that.
So it wasn't just his private life. I mean, the Prime Minister was distracted, partly because, you know, in January, January was the big moment. They'd had quite a winter. I mean, they'd fought an election in December and won. And then it was kind of its full steam ahead to delivering Brexit at the end of January, in the month that the virus first emerged. And I think after the end of January, he kind of just took his foot off the pedal, because I think he felt like he needed a rest. The mixture of things going on. I mean, he is not somebody who temperamentally treated the threat of the virus as anything seriously. And in fact, in his first speech after delivering Brexit at the beginning of February, he described the coronavirus as an irrational panic that we shouldn't overreact to. And then he kind of went off on holiday. And he had a lot of things to attend to because he was divorcing his wife. He was about to announce that he'd become engaged to his girlfriend Carrie, and that they had a child together. And there were all sorts of other things. There was an investigation going on into his relationship with Jennifer Akuri and whether she had received special favours while he was London mayor. And so he had quite a lot on his mind. He was also supposed to be finishing off a book which he had a huge advance for on Shakespeare, but whether he ever did that, I don't know. So he had other things to attend to in his life during that time. And, you know, we could find very little evidence that he was actually doing very much in terms of the virus. Or actually the other big issue at the time, which was at the time there were a series of big storms at the weekends, which were causing flooding across the country. And people were asking, where is the Prime Minister? You know, why hasn't he come to these flood hit areas? And why isn't he doing anything about this threat from the coronavirus? And he just wasn't there until the end of February.
Mm. One of the other things that is quite informative of his mindset is looking at what he was doing when he was missing the five COVID meetings on the virus. So on the first one in January, he was just metres away in Downing Street celebrating Chinese New Year with the Chinese ambassador, which was a country at that very moment that was kind of covering up and failing to properly contain the virus in its own country. The next one, he was hosting a Facebook Live event where he was kind of pontificating about Shakespeare, which he was writing a book about, and also Elizabeth I. Another one, he posted a video on Twitter, a kind of jokey video, asking whether Boris Johnson was for or against Brexit. And on the last one, he was on holiday. It was still only kind of an hour's drive away from the COVID meeting room, so he could have popped in. But he instead took a call from the Chinese president, who wanted to thank Boris Johnson for the British government's donation of more than 200,000 pieces of our precious PPE kit, which in just a few weeks later would become so short that doctors in the UK would start dying from the virus because they weren't adequately protected.
Mm. And I mean, he left then the management of these COBRA meetings to Matt Hancock, a man with a history of ineptitude.
Yeah, Matt Hancock had had a kind of meteoric political rise, despite a few mishaps along the way. He was the first MP, I think, ever to have his own app called the Matt Hancock app, which was supposed to let his constituents know what he was up to on a fairly frequent basis. But when it came out, there were extreme concerns about privacy because it appeared that it actually may have breached privacy law because it kind of scooped up its people's photographs from their own phones, which was kind of ironic because I think his department was responsible for privacy law. Also, he kind of had a history of over-promising. I think when he was in the same department, he'd promised that everybody in the country would have access to super fast broadband by 2020, which I think many of us would attest has not turned out to be true. And obviously, the app, you know, had hit enormous problems when the Department of Health was trying to develop it to assist its track and trace program once the pandemic arose.
There are so many scandals that you uncover in this incredibly well-researched book. I mean, you go through every stage of this crisis and how it was mishandled, from the PPE, as you've mentioned, to this veil of secrecy over things. And I wonder how easy it was to get people to speak to you. You've clearly got some excellent sources, but they were afraid of reprisals, weren't they?
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's very hard for people to talk on the record about this, especially as it was a difficult time, actually, if you remember. I mean, that April, we'd all gone into lockdown. Everyone was quite fearful of the virus. Very few people were at work and the death rate was awful. But there were a number of people who were really quite concerned about the way that this had been handled and were willing to speak because of that, because they were quite angry that we hadn't tackled the threat, which, you know, we've been warned about, and we had time to prepare, and we hadn't. In some ways, it's more difficult because, you know, normally you cultivate sources by meeting people, having lunch, maybe, or having a cup of coffee with them or whatever. But you couldn't do that in lockdown. On the other hand, in some ways, it was easier for people to talk because a lot of people were at home rather than in the office, so they didn't feel like they had someone looking over their shoulder when they were talking to a journalist. And so there were quite a lot of people were willing to talk and tell us exactly what was going on.
Now, the government's excuse has always been that they're just following the science. Now, the two scientists, of course, that we've seen most advising the government, Sir Patrick Vallance and Professor Chris Whitty, how politicised are they?
I mean, we certainly feel that in that first wave, up to around the 14th of March, so 9 days before lockdown, they had seemed to be supporting the kind of mitigation approach that the government was setting out, which was kind of delaying restrictions and allowing a certain amount of the virus to spread through the population, which was effectively a herd immunity approach. And what we discovered was that perhaps the two most important scientists were actually Professor Neil Ferguson and Professor John Edmonds, who were the government's chief modellers. And on the second, around the 2nd of March, they'd actually produced modelling that showed that approach would cause at least 200,000 deaths. Yet the government had then continued to pursue that for a further 10 or so days, which we kind of found remarkable. And the government didn't ask them to then model a lockdown approach, which had proved to be so effective in Wuhan and was then being adopted in Italy. And so Edmonds and Ferguson took it upon themselves to model a lockdown approach. And when they presented those findings in that second week of March to the government, which suggested that the death toll could be cut by down to around 50,000, which was four times less, it then forced the government's hand to change their strategy. And I think it's pretty clear that Patrick Vallance and Professor Chris Whitty did then change their recommendations. And around the 14th of March, there was a crucial meeting in Downing Street where it was accepted by Boris Johnson that we would have to lock down. And at that point, according to the backdated modelling, we had around 200,000 infections across the UK. But tragically, he then spent another 9 days prevaricating over that. And because the virus was doubling every 3 days, it meant that by the 23rd of March, when we did lock down, we had 1.5 million infections across the country, which was more than any other country in Europe had when they locked down. It's the single most important reason why we had the worst death toll in Europe by the end of that first wave.
Another shocking revelation is the triage tool. The fact that many people were forced to sign, or their relatives were forced to sign, do not resuscitate orders. People who otherwise might have lived.
Yeah, when we were looking at what actually happened during the April and May months, the view which was promoted by both the Department of Health and Matt Hancock was that it had been tough, but the NHS had coped. And Matt Hancock would claim that everybody had received the treatment that they needed. But this isn't what the doctors who actually witnessed the scenes in the hospitals told us. They told us that they did have to use things like the triage tool to choose between patients. And this, in effect, meant that for many of the more elderly patients, they were not given intensive care, which they would have been given had the number of cases been less pressing. And so a lot of people were not given the intensive care they needed. And as part of all of that, there was a drive, and we talked to GPs who told us that they were under pressure to try and force people, elderly people, to sign do not resuscitate orders. And one was told that they couldn't go to hospital unless they did sign a DNR. What was happening, and nobody blames the doctors for this, it was just out of sheer necessity, was that some people weren't given the highest level of care. And the stats show, because we managed to get the government's own statistics on this, which are quite detailed, and the stats show that actually many of those people who were denied that sort of care would have benefited from it, and in later times did in fact survive from intensive care. And it's quite an important point, because later, as the pandemic went on, a lot of kind of people say, for example, the right of the Tory party would argue that we should open up restrictions really fast. You know, we could handle the pandemic, because, you know, during the first wave, the NHS coped with it. But our research and the doctors that we talked to suggest that they didn't cope very well, and it was a real nightmare in the first wave.
And that people were being left to die at home. And, of course, as we now know, people were being sent back to care homes, people who had tested positive for the virus.
Yeah, that was absolutely extraordinary. I mean, I should just say, well, one of the most striking statistics that we uncovered from that first wave is that hospitals were so overwhelmed that just one in nine people, approximately, who died of the virus actually received intensive care treatment. And there were more than 40,000 excess deaths in homes and care homes during that period. And you're right. I mean, what that was obviously the care home deaths were caused by, right, the deliberate policy. We've got documentary evidence for it, to send people who were COVID positive into care. Which, you know, it's the most, care homes are the place where the most vulnerable people to the virus were all living. And the staff didn't have the PPE to protect themselves and ensure they didn't become infected, and therefore they then spread it even further around the care homes. And then I think almost one of the most disturbing things was that the care homes then tell us that when the elderly people became seriously ill, they called up the hospitals and the ambulances asking them to take them into hospital, but they just weren't accepting people from care homes. I mean, we spoke to doctors in the Midlands who said that they didn't see a single care home patient in hospital throughout their entire first wave. So they were just left to die in the care home, being looked after by carers who just are not trained up or equipped to deal with people dying of coronavirus. Mm.
There are, I mean, it's such an endless catalogue of mistakes, these U-turns. I mean, the very definition of madness, really, doing the same thing and expecting it to turn out differently. And then you have Dominic Cummings, who completely undermines the stay-at-home message.
Yes, I mean, Dominic Cummings' trip up to Durham was one of the kind of low points for the government. One of the wonderful things about the lockdown, I think we all agree, was just how well everyone pulled together and how people did generally obey the rules and saw the importance of sticking to the rules, and that you know, it was not just something you were doing for yourself, it was something you were doing for other people. And Dominic Cummings, by choosing to do something which kind of he believed was right for his own family, I think kind of broke that understanding. And a lot of people started to think, well, you know, he can break the rules. Well, why can't I? Mm.
And then, of course, you had the universities going back, which sparked another crisis. You saw the scientists appeal at the end of October saying, you know, this has to stop now. And then the whole catastrophe of Christmas. We'll all have Christmas together. And then suddenly, no, we weren't. But then we did. And then we see a spike of deaths come New Year.
Well, I mean, I think the that is where it became kind of unforgivable. I mean, what if you listen to all those press conferences, they used to repeat as a kind of mantra, we're following the science. But what happened from around about July onwards, the government kind of departed from their scientists. And you could see that even the chief scientists were getting increasingly frustrated. And they, in an effort to get the economy going, there was kind of great pressure from the Treasury and Rishi Sunak to kind of open everywhere up on July the 4th. And then there was the Eat Out to Help Out campaign. And by September, there were a huge number of infections and something had to be done. And the scientists were all saying, including the chief scientist and chief medical officer, you've got to have a quick circuit breaker lockdown. And the Prime Minister had understood how important that was, because when he came out of his illness at the end of April, he gave a speech in which he said, look, in order for the economy to thrive, you have to keep infections down. So you have to keep the R below one. And he'd absolutely understood it. But in those summer months, he just threw that out the window. And when it came to the crucial decision in September, he took alternative advice. He actually brought in some scientists who are more of a kind of herd immunity style approach, where scientists who believe that you could protect the elderly and allow the virus to flourish in younger people, which was a kind of mistaken policy. But he listened to them and decided not to go for the circuit breaker lockdown. And the effects of that were enormous, because what happened was they just allowed infections to increase until they got to the end of October. And by then, we had far too many cases. And so we went into a lockdown for 4 weeks in November. And by the time we came out, we still had far too many cases. We were coming out far too early. We were concerned like 16,000 infections. And so it was never, I mean, the idea that we could open up for Christmas was always a pipe dream. And that was before, you know, we got the mutant virus. And the mutant virus in itself was a product of the fact that the more you allowed the infections to spread, the more likely it became that you would get a mutant virus. And in fact, there was a report commissioned by the government which told them that this could happen back in July. But again, the advice just wasn't heeded. Mm.
I mean, the book goes through so many aspects of this, the kind of scandal of the fact that there were government contacts who got very, very valuable contracts. You also look at Rishi Sunak, as you mentioned, and his eat out to help out, and whether, in fact, he is a hero or villain. We don't have time to go into all of that, and I would absolutely urge people to read the book because it's fascinating. But I wonder what happens now, because the All-Party Parliamentary Group on Coronavirus did publish a result of its own inquiry in December. But you've now also got people absolutely pushing for more investigation. And in fact, families are seeking a judicial review.
That's right, absolutely. And we spoke to many of the families, also their lawyers. And that they actually believe that the relatives believe that their loved ones died because, or many of them do, that Johnson didn't properly protect them. And this is centred on the issue that of the three late lockdowns, which from all the people we've spoken to, it's clearly the single most important reason why we've had the worst death toll in Europe, as well as the worst recession of any G7 nation. And that's because, you know, on three occasions, Johnson was advised to act swiftly and decisively, but on each time he dithered and delayed, leaving hospitals so overwhelmed that thousands were dying without the care they needed. And that led to tens of thousands of unnecessary deaths, but also longer, more economically ruinous lockdowns, because it took a longer time to bring the skyrocketing infections back under control. Mm. Now, the families... Their central objective is to have an inquiry, because they want to make sure that is never allowed to happen again. It's made clear that they must nip any fourth wave or third wave, whichever we're up to now, in the bud. Learn the lessons of those three late lockdowns and make sure that never happens again. I mean, we look across the world at countries that have managed to avoid second and third and fourth national lockdowns, and what did they do to prevent that? And what's absolutely clear is that you need to suppress the virus down to very low levels so that track and trace and local lockdowns work. And certainly the families we've spoken to want the Johnson government to do that. And obviously the vaccination program will help hugely with that. And they hope that, I mean, they don't have confidence that Johnson will learn that off his own bat. So that's why they want an inquiry to make sure there are no more unnecessary deaths. Mm.
And finally, I mean, how will history judge this? Will he be saved by the fact that the vaccination programme is such a success?
Time will tell. That's a great unknown. How effective will the vaccination programme be? I mean, it certainly is extremely encouraging. But the damage has been done, though, in terms of we're almost at 150,000 deaths now. And we've got one of the world's worst recessions. And the vaccination program won't change that. And being a couple of months ahead of the rest of Europe won't change that. But it does give us enormous hope that this kind of nightmare will, you know, hopefully there is that we can see an end to it. But we're certainly not out of the woods yet.
Absolutely. Jonathan Calvert and George Arbuthnot, thank you so much for talking to me. I would absolutely urge everyone to read Failures of State, the inside story of Britain's battle with coronavirus, which is published by Mudlark. It tells in startling detail and with some shocking, shocking stories of exactly what was behind the government and particularly the Prime Minister's huge mishandling of the current crisis in which we find ourselves. Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hold and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.